Good evening. My name is David Illman. I'm the director of the Round Church Study Center here. And thank you for coming this evening. Our talk on happiness. You might all have different definitions of what that looks like or how that feels like, especially in the bitter cold. But in this talk, Andrew, our director for the Round Church here, we'll look at what happiness is and provides a brief history of happiness, examining ancient enlightenment and modern versions for the satisfied life. So Andrew will speak for roughly 50 minutes to an hour, then we'll have a bit of Q&A after that. So let's welcome Andrew.
Good. Well, welcome. Nice to see you here tonight. I'm not sure my lecture on happiness is going to make you very happy. But we'll see what happens. If you look through the centuries, few subjects have been given more attention than this one. It absorbs an enormous amount of focus from philosophers, going right back to the beginning. You see it in the work of economists and psychologists in the modern period. And over the last 20 years, there's been a growing body of empirical research, especially from within the social sciences, which devote themselves to the subject of happiness. So I find myself almost overwhelmed by the body of material that we need to wrestle with on the subject. Now, the reason for all this interest, I think, is quite simple, and it's this. All of us, without exception, aspire to happiness. So each of us is engaged in a happiness project. And we act out on life as if we have a gaping hole in our hearts, which is just looking for happiness. That's how we function. And this was put well by the great Blaise Pascal, who said, man, he was pre-politically correct movement, but you know what he means by that. Man wishes to be happy and only wishes to be happy and cannot wish not to be so. So this happiness aspiration, Pascal says, lies behind everything we do, which could be the choice to go to war or the choice not to go to war. He says it's even the motive behind suicide. We take our own life because we believe we'll be happier dead than we are alive. So it lies behind everything we do. So what I want to do in this talk is to stand back and to take a big picture look at happiness. We can call this a happiness outline. So we're going to be covering a lot of material. It's broken down my talk into two main parts. First of all, I want to give the biblical or Christian account for happiness, and then I want to do a very brief history of happiness. So that's where we're going. So first of all, the biblical or Christian account of happiness. Now today, this account for happiness is largely ignored. And when it is referenced, it's usually in derisory tones. It's mocked. But I have to say, in reading quite widely on this subject, I've been struck anew at the sanity of the biblical version of happiness. And I'm going to end my lecture by saying, if there is ever a moment for the recovery of the biblical account, it's now. We really need to get back to the biblical account. And that's because the humanist happiness project is failing terribly. That's going to be one of my assertions. So in terms of the biblical account, I'm going to make three assertions. We're moving through this material very quickly. The first is this. The supreme good is God and not happiness. That's where the Bible begins. The supreme good is God and not happiness. Through the centuries, philosophers have debated the nature of what they call the summum bonum. The summum bonum is the highest good, the ultimate goal we reach for, the supreme good, something you couldn't add anything to because it has this ultimacy to it. And this has actually formed a lot of the debate by philosophers around happiness. Is happiness the great end and telos? Is this the supreme good? Or is it an outcome that flows from reaching to an even higher end? So for the Greek philosopher Aristotle, happiness was the supreme good. And he described this as the eudaimonia. The eudaimonian state was the supreme good. Now, by eudaimonia, he meant happiness, but not happiness as a feeling, it's more as a state. and philosophers today, some philosophers, moral philosophers, would call this the state of human flourishing. That's what he meant by eudaimonia. And he said that is what humans are aiming at as the supreme good. But the Bible is clear that our summum bonum is not happiness, it's God. In his preface to the Proslogion, Anselm spoke of God as the supreme good. He's the supreme good, needing no other. He's the one whom all things have need of for their being and their well-being. God, the supreme good. And we all need him for our well-being. So he is the one that we're meant to reach out for. And that means the point of our existence is not our own happiness, it's God himself. Now, the Bible says, it so happens that he himself is supremely happy. And that's why when he is our supreme good, which means we delight in him, the consequence of that is that we get happiness. That's the biblical picture. He is the supreme good. He's supremely happy. When we delight in him as our chief end, we get happiness. And that's why Pascal affirms in his Penses, as he starts out, that men are happy with God and unhappy without him. Now, to be in a happy state is actually, I think, to be satisfied. So we have this desire for happiness, this happiness aspiration. When it's met, we're satisfied. Now, we live in a moment when happiness surveys have flooded the Western world. And the way these happiness surveys gauge happiness is by testing you on the satisfaction quotient. So happiness surveys tend to use a I'm very satisfied, somewhat satisfied, not very satisfied at all. That's how they work. So the satisfaction quotient to measure it. Now, according to the Bible's Happiness Project, if you reach out beyond yourself and your own happiness to God as the supreme good, you will find yourself ticking the very satisfied box. Now, I say that carefully. Not every Christian would actually say, I'm totally satisfied in God. But as a future hope, we're going to tick that box if he is the supreme good. It's interesting, the opposite of satisfaction is frustration, a way of measuring misery. So if happiness is measured in a kind of satisfaction, unhappiness is measured in a kind of frustration. So as the supreme good, God is the point where our happiness aspirations can be satisfied and not frustrated. That's the point. Now, being clear that the summum bonum is God and not our personal happiness has a huge benefit. And you really need to understand this, I think, to get my lecture. The benefit is this: it will keep you from being miserable. Because, and many have seen this, philosophers, even recent research, that if you give the issue of your own happiness too much attention, it makes you unhappy. It's true. So Eric Hoffer says, the search for happiness is one of the chief sources of unhappiness. If you focus on it too much, you're never going to get it. It will frustrate you. And I think this has a bearing on our modern happiness project. We're giving happiness too much attention. I think happiness today has almost become an imperative. Be happy. And it's signposted everywhere. You see it in lots of advertising. Buy this and you can be happy. Be happy. You see it a lot in social media. I think today we've become enslaved by the imperative of happiness. And that's a huge amount of pressure. I felt this as a parent when some of my kids just had to have the happiest Christmas and the happiest birthday. And you feel all this pressure to create the happiness. And it's amazing how quickly it can fall apart. Well, the Bible here, stating God as the supreme and the summum bonum, actually frees us from that pressure. The supreme good is not your own happiness, it's God. And the outcome of that is your happiness, but seek him first. It'll save you from misery. My second assertion. on the biblical Christian account. Our well-being is dependent on a number of happiness fields within the order of creation. Now, this is very fundamental to what I want to do in terms of this evening. Our well-being is dependent on a number of happiness fields within the order of creation. So here's how it works. The supreme good is God himself, and to be related to him is the ground of our happiness. However, we also need to assert that because God himself is supremely happy, the world he has made is in the interest of our happiness. So we should expect to find fields of happiness within the created order. And I believe we can analyze the world we live in and discover a number of happiness fields. I believe they're observable. There's even empirical data for these fields. Now, in the interest of time, I'm not going to go into any detail. I'm blazing through this. But each of these is a lecture. But let's go through the fields of happiness. The first is the brain fields. Before the dawn of neuroscience, the German philosopher Schopenhauer, who wasn't a happy man, he was a really unhappy man. He actually asserted that happiness is a predisposition. And it just comes down to the luck of the draw. Some are born to be happy and others are born not to be happy. Now, there's actually empirical evidence to back that up. Our brain chemistry has a direct impact on our feeling happy or not. Now, that could be either good news or bad news for you this evening. And why do I say that? Well, because some of you will have chemical secretions in your brain, in the middle of your brain, that are working well and that bring you happiness, and others of you don't have that. Terrible, but that's the way it is. And within this field, there's not a whole lot you can do when it comes to the happiness project. Your happiness is hardwired. Now, of course, it is possible to introduce chemicals into your body. And these chemicals can directly impact your feeling of happiness. That's what psychoactive drugs do. Cocaine, heroin. You introduce these drugs because they give you euphoria. It's a direct brain impact. Or you can use certain pharmacologies which chemically change your point of view. That's what antidepressants do. They target this part of us. So we can introduce chemicals which actually impact this brain fields. And increasingly, lots and lots of people today are reverting to this as a shortcut to happiness. In some respects, we're right in the Brave New Worlds. We've all got little soma. Remember, Huxley? We've got little soma doses that we can all take to make us feel more happy. That works in the brain fields. The next field I want to talk about is the feeling fields. And this is where the subjective side of happiness really comes into its own. It's where you, the subject, feel either happy or unhappy. And we have a capacity as human subjects to be aware of our happiness or our lack of happiness. So we can name it and signify it. We can say, I feel good, I feel fine, I feel wonderful. Like Bob in the film, What About Bob? Or we can say, I feel miserable, life sucks, I want to jump off a cliff. We can name our feeling state. Now I'm going to name 10 happiness fields. And these happiness fields actually come in two main groups. And I've just named the first group. The first two belong to the subject side of the happiness project. So these are what I call the affective fields or the happiness fields. So it's what we experience in the realm of emotion and mood. Now, the way to get at the difference between the two in this group at the bottom and the rest I'm going to mention in a moment is in the question, are you happy, and what is happiness? To say, are you happy, actually puts the question to you And you have to ask yourself, am I happy? You have to gauge whether you as the subject in the affective fields have happiness, whether that's the state you're in. The second, what is happiness, is how you gauge happiness more on the object side of the equation. So there you think about what truly makes for happiness. So what, am I happy? That's the affective fields, the subject side. What is happiness? That's going to open up a whole new load of fields for happiness. Now, the point I want to develop tonight is that in the modern period, the happiness project has been reduced to the affective fields, to brain and to feeling, to what we experience in the realm of emotion and mood. And this functions in a range from yum, which is positive feeling, to yuck, which is negative feeling. That's where we are in terms of the affective field today. We'll come back to that in a moment. So those are the first two fields. The next one up, which is in the second group, is what I call the thought or belief fields. And this field is key to our happiness. Now, it actually works in several ways. It's actually possible to experience happiness in the affective fields by what occurs in the thought fields. Some philosophers call this intellectual satisfaction. You can actually experience happiness in ideas. I'm one of those strange people. I find much of my happiness in the realm of ideas. Back into the affective fields again. We also have to state how the thought field deeply impacts happiness as an estate. Because you got the affective on the lower side. On the upper side, we're talking about happiness as state or estate, which is more objective. And the thought field deeply impacts happiness there. Because our happiness projects need to submit to what is true. So something that is true corresponds with the real world. So the real world is what we might call the truth maker, and our beliefs, our thoughts, are truth carriers. And when these two match up, it's a good thing. And in our happiness project, that ought to happen. Now, people often pursue happiness projects that don't correspond with truth. So engaging in child pornography makes some people feel happy. That's why they do it. But is this really a happiness estate? Does child pornography further your well-being? And does it further the well-being of the children who are involved? And does it make for the common good of the society we belong to? So there are all kinds of thoughts which are attached to engaging child pornography that need to be submitted to the truth test, to your thoughts, to your beliefs, to see whether it corresponds with what is true. So in order for our happiness project to succeed, we need thoughts and beliefs that line up with truth, fundamental for the happiness state. The next field here I call the volitional fields. And this field reminds us that happiness doesn't just happen to us. It's actually something that we have to actively choose for. Now, there's actually empirical evidence that volition, our choices, impacts affectivity at the level of the brain, on the subject side. To choose well actually does something here in terms of our feelings of happiness. But the point is, our well-being as an estate, both on the subject side and the object side, is determined by our choices. So it's not enough that we just think about life, have right thoughts and beliefs about life. We have to act upon the worlds. So if some of our misery, I've been here before, is linked to being overweight and lacking in energy, we can actually choose for something that changes that, which addresses that. Or if a relationship with one of our kids is falling apart and causing everyone misery, we can act in the interests of that relationship. And actually, I would say passivity, with respect to how we do life, is the enemy of happiness and the cause of misery. Because it fails in the volitional field. Passivity is deadly for happiness. Because the choice volitional field is part of what's involved. It's interesting, the French Renaissance philosopher Montaigne wrote a lot about happiness. It was one of his main projects. Most of what he said is really at odds with the Bible. But he does helpfully emphasize that our choices for happiness need to fit and be in conformity with the shape of who we are, with our character, with our sensibilities, with our physical constitution. So, application of this in terms of choosing for life and for happiness, if you have an artistic temperament, perhaps you ought not to choose being an accountant. Or if you're like me, rather uncoordinated, it might be a mistake to choose to go into ballet. We have to choose according to our temperament and our constitution and so forth. It's another important happiness field. The next one is the social fields. It's interesting, these happiness surveys, which are all over, suggest that of all the factors that influence happiness, relatedness to others is at or very near the top of the list. In terms of what people feed back, this is where I find my greatest happiness. And conversely, loneliness is one of the biggest factors in terms of human unhappiness today. So it's this field that reminds us that happiness requires communion. Happiness is about something shared. We are dependent on the input of others in order to be happy. And again, there's actually evidence apparently showing how happiness is contagious. Happiness spreads when you're in a social group. So this again focuses on the objective estate in which happiness is dependent. We need family, we need friends, we need neighbors. And this objective estate has a deep impact on affectivity, how we feel. The next field of happiness I call the material objects or material goods fields. And this one is very interesting. Lots of research today has been invested here. Now, I think we need to start by saying our happiness as a fact, feeling, is dependent on what we might call the bare necessities. We need a certain amount of food, covering for our bodies, shelter over our heads at night, all premised on the fact that if you don't have enough to eat and you're sleeping on the streets, happiness is going to elude you, unless you're Francis of Assisi. And he had other reasons to be happy. So again, there's a direct correspondence between our estate in this field of material goods and affectivity, how we feel. But this actually leads to one of the most important happiness questions that is around today. And the question is, how much is enough when it comes to material goods? How much is enough? And it's interesting because the research shows that as important as material objects and goods are to our happiness, the empirical data is uncovering what is known today as the paradox of happiness. And the paradox is this: an increase of wealth and material goods tends to lead to a decline with the satisfaction of your life. That's what the data is beginning to show. I've always suspected that, but the data is beginning to bear that out. The more your wealth increases, the more unhappy and unsatisfied you become. Not Bible saying this, this is what the research is saying. So the quantity, this is the issue here, the quantity of material goods that fill up your life make little difference to your happiness. It's another way of saying that happiness cannot be bought or purchased. Now, the great pre-Socratic philosopher Epicurus really understood this. He was another philosopher preoccupied with a happiness project. And Epicurus said that a lot of our unhappiness is fed by a dissatisfaction with what we have. Because what we have is this, but actually we want more. So we're always reaching out for more, and the reaching out for more makes us terminally dissatisfied and unhappy. So he came to the conviction that one of the keys to happiness is moderation. Just moderate what you go looking for. He put it as an imperative. Just be content with bare necessities. with food, simple food, a home, simple experiences. Focus on the quality of what you have rather than the quantity, and you'll likely have a happier life. There's a lot of wisdom in that. So much more could be said of that and all these things. Let's move on. The aesthetic fields. The aesthetic fields. In my research of all the happiness fields, this is the one that was given least attention, certainly in terms of contemporary research. But I would assert that happiness and beauty have a vital link together. So take the link, firstly, between ugliness and unhappiness. When someone falls into an unhappy state on the affective side, this is usually, if not always, reflected in their bedroom or their study or their physical appearance. It touches us. It spills over. Unhappiness to disorder, which has an aesthetic side to it. Conversely, to be in a habitat that's marked by beauty has a very positive impact on affectivity. And we actually know that music can trigger euphoria in the brain. That one's clearly established. But I think beauty of all sorts actually leads to happiness. So our subjective happiness is impacted by this aesthetic fields. Back in the 40s, Lewis preached a sermon to a group of Oxford students, which is entitled Learning in Wartime. And Lewis said, if you reject aesthetic satisfaction, you will fall into sensual satisfaction. Basically saying that beauty elevates our happiness aspirations. It takes us beyond the merely sensual, the merely affective. So as we think about the happiness, not just of ourselves as individuals, but of a whole culture, I think we need to assert that the aesthetic field really matters. And the uglier a culture becomes, in terms of its arts, in terms of its cityscapes, the deeper its unhappiness. The two are linked together. The next field I mention is the justice fields. I think the happiness of all of us is deeply impacted by this field here. When an injustice touches our lives, either directly, here in Cambridge, someone took your parking spot, or indirectly, lots of things wrong in the city and in the world. Whenever injustice touches our lives, it's a matter of dissatisfaction. It's a matter of deep frustration. Any situation in our lives that requires justice is in need of correction, of restoring the balance and equilibrium. So when justice is frustrated, the result is deep unhappiness. And I would say it should be. It's meant to be. Whereas when justice prevails, personally, in a nation, it makes for great happiness. This is one of the points Plato argues in his book, The Republic. He says it a number of times that justice is a key component of the happy life. And the Bible affirms this. Happy are they who observe justice. Psalm 106, verse 3. My ninth field is the virtue field. The virtue field. Many, many great minds have said that the road to happiness is paved with virtues. And it's this field where Aristotle thought the happy life would be achieved. Human flourishing is dependent on the cultivation of the virtuous life. Now, the Bible over and over affirms this in the language of righteousness. Psalm 68, verse 3, but the righteous shall be glad. They shall exult before God. They shall be jubilant with joy. The righteous being the virtuous. So the more developed our character, what we might call the habits of our heart, the more developed by the norms of goodness, the happier we are. Now again, there is a growing body of research today that highlights this point. There's a social psychologist by the name of Pilin Kisibar. She wrote a long paper called The Virtue Cycle, the relationship between happiness and virtue. She says, we present a plethora of research exploring the link between virtue and happiness. Virtue, she says, is good for happiness. The first line of evidence for this assertion comes from studies showing that doing good is associated with feeling good. Virtue impacts happiness. And then finally, and at the top, is the religious fields. Now again, I understand that when we look at the brain, we can see part of us is wired up for transcendence. And as we reach out to this realm of reality that goes beyond the material, beyond the seen, it impacts our affective state, the bottom two, in a positive manner. And this can be seen in the brain. Now, I would argue that as the worldview of our civilization has increasingly gone down what I call the lockdown state, scientific materialism, matter is all there is, we have become, with that lockdown state, correspondingly more miserable. It has led to greater misery. And that's why huge numbers today are revolting and engaging in a happiness project in this religious field. It's a rejection of naturalism. So we see today the multiplication of spiritual therapies, alternative ways of achieving happiness in the religious fields. I think the explosion of the mindfulness movement would be one example. Now, what interests me here is that much of what occurs in that field works, even if it's not true to what's there in that field. It actually deeply impacts people's happiness. It works. And as Christians, I'm a Christian, I don't think we should deny that. Mindfulness is good for people. Other spiritual therapies also. It increases happiness as affectivity on the subject side. Now, of course, Christianity affirms this field. And it says the whole focus of this field is the Trinitarian God, who in relationship, in the sociality of the Trinity, is supremely happy. And Christianity says that is where our happiness is grounded. It's grounded in God. So this happiness field, the religious one, exists within creation because we engage God, the true God, within creation. But it also goes beyond creation. It exists into the unseen. It actually exists into the eternal realm, because this is an eternal God, if we're going to treat this field as the Bible says we should. So, there they are. Those are the 10 happiness fields. Let me tie them together by asserting two things. We could say so much about these, but this is big picture, I told you. Two things I want to sort of wrap it up in. The first is this. Our happiness depends on each of these fields. So if any of these fields is compromised, our happiness is going to be impacted negatively. So what I'm presenting here highlights that happiness is actually quite a complex business. Some thinkers acknowledge this, but I was amazed in the more contemporary research at how many people reduced happiness to one or two of these fields. Where the Bible gives us this big picture, it's quite complex. And all of these are dependent on each other in terms of the happiness project. The second thing I do to tie it all together is this. When all of these fields are in their proper place, we enter shalom. Shalom is the integration of all these fields. Shalom is the Jewish way of reflecting happiness. The eudaimonian state. It's where everything is in its right and proper place, and there's an integrated wholeness. So the harmony of all these fields within the creation order, and the harmony to the supreme good, God himself. And that harmony includes both the subject as happiness fields, the affectivity ones, and the objective, the estate ones. Shalom is all of this in integrated wholeness. Right, my third point on the biblical account, this one's short. The biblical creation, fall, and redemption narrative is essential to understand how the happiness project is going to work. We have to keep this in view. I've just said that the integrated wholeness of all of the fields is shalom. And I think all of us would acknowledge that this is a long way from our experience. And I hope we want to know why. Why is this so far from experience? Well, the biblical account for happiness gives the reason in this narrative structure. The first bit is the creation part. And the creation part of the biblical narrative is the affirmation that God is for our happiness. And actually, I think we often need that reassurance because our existence can be very miserable sometimes. Go back to creation. God is for our happiness. I need to know that sometimes because sometimes it looks like he's for my misery. He's for my happiness. It's written into creation. And those happiness fields are all in creation. You need a strong creation theology to deal with happiness effectively. Otherwise, you say we just have to get to heaven and get happy. No, there's fields in the creation. And this happiness was originally written in. And it was written in because this is in the nature of God, creation. Then we have the fall. Now, the fall part of the story helps us grasp why there are so many factors in our present experience that frustrate happiness. And the Bible links all these frustrations back to Genesis 3, which we call the fall. And Genesis 3 roots the happiness problem in human agency. We're responsible. We broke something, and therefore we're unhappy. We did it. Doesn't answer the question fully, but that's what Genesis 3 states. So when the shadow of the fall fell across creation, all of it, it had an impact on all the factors that make for our happiness. Every one of these happiness fields was touched. So the fall was the vandalization of shalom. It vandalized it. It had a negative impact on all the happiness fields, right down to the low levels of serotonin secretions in your brain, if that's what you suffer from, the fall. Now, the catastrophe of the fall is so great, the Bible says, that it's beyond human agency to engineer a fix to this. It really is a huge problem. That's what the Bible emphasizes. We can't engineer a complete fix, and that leads to the redemption part of the narrative. Creation, fall, redemption. Because we can't engineer a fix to the happiness problem, the Creator himself has intervened. So he's taken responsibility for the problem by sending his son on a restore happiness mission. That's what Jesus came to do, is a restore happiness mission. And he has fully accomplished this. The implications still have to be worked out, but he's fully accomplished it. It's a finished work, redemption. Creation, fall, redemption. That leads then to the final piece of the narrative, restoration. Restoration. In our misery, am I the only one who gets miserable sometimes? In our misery, we all want to know if there really is a promised land. Is there a place that's going to deliver happiness? And the biblical account of happiness says, yes, there is a promised land, and it's going to be secured when Jesus returns. So that means that our happiness project has to take into account that the complete package is something that is going to be deferred. So there's only going to be a deep and abiding happiness in the beyond. The biblical narrative says that we have to wait for the complete restoration of the project. And that means within this biblical narrative, we're able to moderate our happiness expectations. On the one hand, we say happiness does have a now factor. And this emphasis to creation, where the happiness fields work, we can see there that there's a way laid out for us for how we can attain happiness. This is how it ought to work. So it allows happiness in the present. But alongside the now is the not yet. Because everything continues to function under the shadow of the fall, we're not surprised as Christians by all the factors that frustrate our happiness. It doesn't flip us out, or it shouldn't. Because we know that our happiness aspirations won't be fully satisfied until Christ returns. then it's put back together fully. So that means a Christian ought to be able to live with dissatisfaction in terms of the happiness aspiration. In fact, I think the Bible says our dissatisfaction, our frustration, is the energy that moves our longings to reach out and say, "How long, O Lord, before you bring it all back, bring it on fully?" Right, boy, I'm in trouble. A very brief, and it's very, very brief, history of happiness. The pre-Enlightenment, the ancient world, basically it came down to this. Make the best of it here, but your real hope for happiness lies in the world to come. Now, this wasn't just Christianity. It's also true of other worldviews prior to the Enlightenment. You take the Elysian Fields of the Greek myths. That's how they conceived of the afterlife, their version of paradise. The word Elysium means to be deeply stirred to joy. But you had to wait for it. And then in Europe from the 5th century onwards, as we became steadily more Christian, the worldview of creation, fall, redemption, restoration shapes us. And this weights the happiness project very much to the other side. It's a state deferred until after you die. Now, my critique, and it's a big one, of the pre-Enlightenment happiness project is this. We didn't give enough attention to happiness in the now. And with respect to the ruling elite who were born into their privilege, it meant a callous disregard for the misery of the masses. Those poor, wretched ones, and I would have been one of them, were just born into their unhappy estate, and they just need to stay faithful to their God, and one day he will reward you. It was pretty callous. So this wretchedness came with a sense that this is assigned to me by God, so better not try and change it, and just accept that in the future it's all going to be okay. That's the pre-Enlightenment. It's not great. Within our narrative structure, but it's not great. The Enlightenment version. Three things I want to highlight here in terms of the Enlightenment happiness project. The first is that the focus turns to happiness now. As God, as Christianity are displaced, a huge shift occurs in the modern happiness project. No longer does the biblical narrative, creation, fall, redemption, and future restoration, rule the minds and imagination of moderns. Remember, in that account, happiness is the outcome of God being your summum bonum. And he also takes responsibility for restoring happiness, which is somewhat deferred. Humanism comes in and replaces all of this. And that means that happiness is something that must now be self-determined. And all the inertia for the happiness project is to the now, to the here and now. And that is why happiness becomes the new cultural preoccupation from the Enlightenment onwards. Louis-Antoine de Saint-Just, a political leader during the French Revolution, said that at the time of the Enlightenment, happiness is a completely new idea in Europe. Wow. As if we invented happiness. The humanists did. Voltaire was another key French Enlightenment philosopher. He wrote a poem entitled The Man of Society. It's not a good poem. But there's a line there which is delicious. Voltaire says, "The earthly paradise is where I am." Wow. The earthly paradise is where I am. It's a direct dig at the Christian worldview. No more waiting for a paradise in the future. I am part of the earthly paradise, and I'm helping to bring this in, and it's a now thing. Now, this is all pretty heady stuff. Back then, this project made them happy. Just thinking about happiness and what they could do made them very, very happy. It's heady. It's let's build utopia now. But I think we should see that that's a lot of pressure on these poor people. A lot of pressure to build paradise now. And if they're unable to deliver, the levels of frustration are going to mount up. Especially given that more and more attention is given to happiness now. It becomes a preoccupation. So that has all kinds of potential to increase our unhappiness and make us miserable. And I believe this is where the Enlightenment Happiness Project has backfired in terms of where we are today. It promised so much. There was so much optimism that man can be perfected in his happiness, and it hasn't delivered. We're still waiting for our promised land, and we're losing our hope in the Happiness Project. We're deeply frustrated. Secondly, the new Department of Supreme Happiness is the political and economic establishments. That's the new Department of Supreme Happiness. No longer the church, no longer religion, it's politics and economics. Enlightenment happiness is no longer grounded in religion, it's grounded in the polis. And it was in the interest of this that the Enlightenment philosophers of the 18th century gave increasing focus and attention to political philosophy and to economics. It just burgeons at that point. Well, this is undergirded, all their interests, by this idea of humankind being perfected, which included happiness. And the place where the Happiness Project was going to be realized was through the state maintaining good order, shalom, and the free markets. Now, it's very important to see that the Enlightenment Happiness Project started out in eudaimonian terms. Happiness as an estate, that's eudaimonia. So happiness continued to be framed in this way rather than pure affectivity. You see this with John Locke, who declared that the peace, safety, and public good of the people are the ends of political society, and that the well-being of the people, eudaimonia, that's what he's referring to, shall be the supreme law. So happiness is seen in terms of well-being, and that depended on the objective states which were outside the self. So at the beginning of the Enlightenment Project, Happiness Project, there is some place for all the fields. The exception would be religion. You did your duty there, but you weren't going to find happiness there. Happiness now is not grounded in God as a summum bonum. It's now grounded in the self, humanism, the self at the center of everything. And it's through the agency of the new God, of the self, that we would mastermind a paradise through the agencies of the polis, the political, and the economic realm. And then thirdly, we see the shift to happiness as affectivity. Didn't start there, but it ended there. As the Enlightenment Happiness Project progressed, you can detect this change from estate to effect. Some say Thomas Jefferson knew exactly what he was doing when he changed Locke's trilogy of life, liberty, and property into life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which is enshrined in the American Declaration of Independence. So this locates the individual pursuit of happiness at the heart of politics. But the significant thing now is that the individual pursuit of happiness doesn't have to be grounded in anything greater than the self. So every individual is now free to pursue their own happiness project. So happiness is now defined in much more individualistic terms. My personal happiness and my right to pursue it. And the only restriction is that your pursuit of happiness shouldn't interfere with another's pursuit. As Jefferson put it, your individual pursuit should neither pick my pocket nor break my leg. Now, this easily lends itself to the pursuit of happiness as that which makes me feel good. It goes back there. Now, Jefferson is not the only one redefining happiness so it weights to affectivity at the expense of an estate. We actually also see it in economic theory. The Enlightenment quite quickly gave rise to something called utilitarianism. Utilitarianism is built around the golden rule, the greatest happiness for the greatest number. The greatest happiness for the greatest number. Jeremy Bentham, whose body's pickled somewhere in London, his brain was pickled before they pickled him. No, I'm just kidding. Bentham was the founder of utilitarianism, And Bentham makes happiness equal to pleasure. Listen to this. Nature has placed mankind under the governance of two sovereign masters, pain and pleasure. Yum and yuck. Now, in terms of economic theory, the reason individuals should pursue wealth, he said, is in order to maximize happiness as pleasure. So now the dominant happiness field is the affective, brain and feeling. Now that's a radical departure from the classical vision of happiness, which allowed the objective happiness fields to have their proper place. And these were quite independent of the affective fields, that is, how you might feel at any given moment. Now, this thesis is developed by two contemporary Italian philosophers, Luigino Bruni and Stefano Zamagni, in their paper, very interesting, The Challenges of Public Happiness, an Historical Methodological Reconstruction. Well worth a read. Final section in my very brief history, the post-Enlightenment condition. I put it like this. Today we have witnessed the triumph of the affective when it comes to the happiness project. The triumph of the affective. The affective revolution, we might call it, has taken no prisoners, and it rules supreme in our times. And now the happiness ideal is grounded in nothing but our own feelings. It's reduced to affectivity. The new happiness ideal. The brain field and the feeling field, which is affectivity. So the happiness project is ruled by these two fields. That's my point. And everything else has to submit to the domination of that, affectivity. It really is the affective revolution. Now, there are two consequences that flow from this. The first is this. The happiness project has now become entirely naturalized, with the emphasis here on nature. It's part of the irony of the new happiness ideal. It feels so much like freedom. I can pursue my pleasure, but to pursue our pleasure as the supreme good is actually grounded in nothing more than nature. Because that's where the first two happiness fields exist. The brain, and then feeling, which is also bodily, the affect within the body. It's entirely within the material. That's what it's reduced to. It's naturalized. Now, what occurs in these two fields at any given moment might be real. It is real. But it's also nothing more than sentiment. It's good, it feels good, or it feels bad. But the pleasure or the pain in the affect receptors are merely surface. They lack depths. And I think we should see today that when the happiness project gets reduced to the material, we in effect, to use Lewis's words in Abolition of Man, give up our souls. We give up our souls. So the affective revolution is really the institutionalization of the sensate. And the result of this is the shutting down of the higher functions. So as humans, we have in our inner life higher functions, and the soul somewhat encapsulates that. In the affective state, these are shut down. And we need to appreciate that the affective state, brain, and body affect is feeling, is both alogical and amoral. Affectivity is alogical and amoral, incapable of producing rationality or producing virtue. So you can't move from the affective state, you can't move from that to morality or to rationality. It can't produce those fields. And that's why the affective revolution is quickly giving rise to a social condition where the words good and bad have lost their meaning and content. Good and bad. Lewis said this prophesied this in the Abolition of Man. The words good and bad would lose their meaning. So it's increasingly difficult to make the judgment that this is good thinking or bad thinking when affectivity rules. And it's the same with morality. Is this moral good or not moral good? If you're led by affectivity, it's very hard to make those judgments. So the affective fields can be a guide to the rational life or the moral life. Now, the true and good happiness project will never be in doubt that the affective fields require the other happiness fields, more on the objective side. So the affective field has to be trained by the other fields. So it's not hard to demonstrate that we are more than capable of liking or disliking in the affective fields of happiness what violates the rational norms of the rational field or the virtue fields. So we may like crystal meth because it brings us pleasure, but that actually violates rationality and virtue. So the problem when affectivity rules is this. We lose a framework for training our emotions. And that's why C.S. Lewis called for the head to rule the stomach, affectivity through the chest, through these inner faculties. You see, the affective fields of happiness have to be in harmony with the other givens of reality. The other happiness fields. They have to be lined up with something which is outside of our affects. So this grounds them in something which has objective value. And this is so important because affectivity on its own can't produce virtue. It can't produce something which is rational. Now, the result of happiness being naturalized, being rooted in affectivity, is that our judgments now about reality get reduced to yum or to yuck. And actually, that means we begin to function on the level of the animals. And actually, the only moral duty that we ask of others today is, don't yuck my yum. It's the one imperative. You can do anything, just don't yuck my yum. Secondly, this new happiness ideal is undermining the foundation of Western civilization. No longer is this new happiness ideal rooted in affectivity merely individual. No longer is it merely private, as Jefferson said it would be. Happiness as affectivity now occupies a central place in the public square. So in the last decade, we've seen the affective revolution become a driving force in the formation of public opinion and public policy. So this accounts for what's known today as the era of post-truths. After the American elections, everybody started talking about post-truth reality. And actually, just a few weeks ago, the Oxford Dictionary made this their word of the year. They announced that post-truth has been selected as the word which more than any other reflects this past year in terms of language. And it defines post-truth, listen, as relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal preference. Post-truth. Now, this is exactly what we witnessed with Brexit and the recent American presidential elections. There we saw levels of irrationality that beggared belief. It was truly astounding. In terms of the debate, the public debate, it was just yum or yuck. It didn't go much beyond that. And when a civilization stoops to that level, it's a cause for major concern. Think about these choices. So this account, the effective revolution, accounts for the era of post-truth. It also accounts for the era of after virtue. This is from the title of Alistair MacIntyre's remarkable book on ethics. He says, we're now emotivist. Now, it's interesting. MacIntyre says by emotivism that our moral judgments are premised on personal preference. So it's premised on, I approve of that. But I would contend that we've moved beyond that now. And the effect of revolution has reduced our moral judgments to yum or yuck, which is even beyond approval. It's just yum, yum, awful. So when affectivity rules in the public place, every motive other than felt emotion is going to fail. So that means there isn't any real place now for rational discussion. Public policy is increasingly formed within the illogical and amoral affective fields. So that means that the triumph of the affective has created a morally indeterminate situation for our civilization. And we see that. We know it can change so quickly in terms of what determines the public yum or yuck. Yesterday, the big yum was liberalism. And I think it was now yesterday. Today, it feels like the yum is more alt-right. Whoa, it shifts so quickly. So today, the moral consensus is rooted in affectivity. It's like trolling social media. It's in the public place. It's either a like, the meme thumbs up, or a dislike, thumbs down. So it is that the public square has been reduced to positive effect versus negative effect. And this is developed by a professor of sociology at the University of Jerusalem, Eva Eloise. Her remarkable book, Cold Intimacies, The Making of Emotional Capitalism. Do you know that one, Flo? You do need to read that. It's amazing. She's looking at how affectivity now works in the public arena. And she says this emotional capital, which dominates the public square, is at the expense of the thought field, the virtue field, and the religious fields. So think about the issue of same-sex marriage. Where did it come from? How did it happen? Well, basically, an emotional capital was created in the public space. And this was largely by the liberal establishment in tandem with the media. And it functioned entirely within the affective fields. So it gave same-sex marriage a yum factor. Our former Prime Minister, David Cameron. Why would I deny gay people the happiness I have in my marriage? Now, that's just so illogical. There's nothing rational you can sort of get at in that statement. It's pure affectivity. We can talk about happiness for gay people. I think we should. But the way he related it made no sense whatsoever. And at the same time, the affective field, culturally in this one, created a yuck factor around the old view of marriage. So here's an old view that has lasted for millennia, which quickly got a negative affect field attached to it. It became laden with the yuck factor. So intolerant. So all it takes is a certain manipulation to create a sense of yuck or yum. Positive effect or negative effect. And if you do that right, everyone's going to run with it. And that's the terrifying thing today. We have cultural conditioners who can create all of this very, very easily. And that's the problem. When the affective field is cut off from the other happiness field, we are vulnerable to gross manipulation. C.S. Lewis calls this conditioning. Conditioning. When the affective state rules the public square, it is, in the words of Lewis, the power of some people to make others what they please. So the forming of public opinion is now a matter of PR, which is another way of saying public bullshit. The power of the elites to manipulate feeling. And it's actually what all tyrannies have resorted to. Hitler, Stalin, it's called propaganda. Just conditioning, manipulating, feeling about things, back and forth. So, if there was ever a moment when the biblical account of happiness was required, it's now. We need the restoration of all the happiness fields, including the affective, brain, feeling, rationality, right up to religious, including virtue as we go through to the religious. It needs to be a focus on the now, unlike the pre-Enlightenment period. We should be interested, all Christians should be interested in the happiness fields now, but we're realistic in terms of what can be delivered. I think there's few things more critical than getting the Happiness Project right in terms of our civilization. Good. That is more than enough for me. Thank you for being patient. We've covered a lot of ground. Thank you. Let's open it up for some questions now. We've got a roving mic. Florence, I thought you'd get your hand up first.
Yeah, and then Ian. So with the fields, I've got a really loud voice. Okay. With the fields, the aesthetic one,
yep.
I think, so how do we create a sense of aesthetic satisfaction when part of PR is manipulating what our sense of aesthetic satisfaction and dissatisfaction is? I find myself a lot more aesthetically satisfied when I'm wearing makeup. I don't share Rembrandt's taste for a rounded tummy, that kind of thing. That's been very much twisted and manipulated. So how do I create a sense of aesthetic satisfaction when that's prime for conditioning?
So this is the aesthetic very much of the self in terms of
Well,
what
I also
wear.
Find bifolding doors really attractive because Kirsty Alsop on Location told me so. So everything about interior design, it's all up for commercial grabs.
Yeah. I mean,
I don't anymore. After 10 series, I think I've had my fill.
I mean, there is a lot in the aesthetic field which has subjectivity in it. All those fields have subjectivity in it. It's not as if they're all completely objective. I bifurcated it a little bit too much. But are you saying how do we make a judgment on what is ugly and what's beautiful?
Yeah. What is rightly?
Yeah. When we're conditioned. Yeah, I think tradition, I think that can break through conditioning. Because part of the conditioning of the modern period of happiness is actually chucking tradition out. And in art, the tradition is being a sort of canon that gets a say on what's beautiful and what's not beautiful. So who was it? Was it Chesterton called it the democracy of the dead. That the dead get a little say in what's beautiful and what's not beautiful. I actually, the more crazy things become, the more I feel that there's a very important point there. It's not gospel, it's not Bible, absolute authority, but I think it's a clear indication to help us navigate between what really is beautiful and what's not, to overcome conditioning.
But they had their own, genres and stereotypes.
Sure.
So how do we make sure we're not trading in one conditioning for another?
Yeah. I mean, if we're aiming for shalom and all those fields are working, I think we come up with a number of criteria that help us. In terms of making a judgment, what's good and bad. Well, I think what I want to say is that good and bad have content and meaning when it comes to aesthetics. It's not always very, very clear, but we're not completely at the whim of our subjectivity or the conditioners. I'd like to hear you on this point, but
I'd like to hear
you
too.
Ian had a question.
Well, that's a very enjoyable lecture. Thank you so much, Andrew. I'm just wondering if you put all of our search for well-being and happiness into the affective. How do you explain, which you mentioned, the kind of tremendous interest in spirituality? And also, how do you explain our society's preoccupation with political correctness as a kind of new piety?
Yep.
Because my point would be that actually human beings are still, despite everything you say, and alongside everything you say, are sort of religious animals.
Indeed.
And have to justify themselves.
Yep.
And they do that by making themselves feel good by a sort of giving themselves a moral self-esteem.
Yep.
And also by giving themselves sort of vague feelings of spirituality
yep.
and of meaning.
Yep.
Because they sort of realize that it's not enough, just the feeling in the brain isn't enough. There's got to be something more.
Yep.
But of course, if they've got no framework, that something more is terribly distorted.
Yep.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, on the religious side, I think post-Carl Jung in the West, when we go for the religious, we try to reconcile the terms there back to the self. So it's still very self-referential. And yeah, and it becomes, therefore, you can trade it in for something else. So I met someone recently who was a Christian, became a Buddhist, because they actually just said, I could actually get myself into a happier state far more quickly with Buddhism than I could in Christianity. But I mean, I don't want to be cynical at all. I think the upper fields never die completely. But when I talk to people who have a social justice issue, and then you try to engage them on the reasons, the rationale for why they're engaged in this, I get so little beyond the soundbite, and it doesn't sound like much more than this is my yum factor to go after this. Now, there are many exceptions to that, but that's...
Yeah, I agree with that. I think a lot of it's just moral vanity.
Yeah.
Instead of virtue signaling, it makes me feel good.
Yeah.
And you need to listen to me because, look, I'm engaged in these important things.
Yeah.
I don't want to be too cynical,
but yeah.
I agree with
you. Yep. So for me, it's still it's the effect of which drives it and motivates it and moves it. Lila.
Excellent talk. In preparing, did you come across folks that argued we are happier now than an ancient people?
Yeah.
And yeah. What were the arguments?
Yeah. I mean, again, it depends how you approach happiness. In terms of the material goods field, the rise of the middle classes has distributed goods much more equitably. So lots of people would like more, but they have enough. So on that scale, they're happier. But in other fields, I think there they showed themselves to be much less happy. I mean,
I think it's much easier to make the case that we're less happy. Yeah. Now
yeah.
Than more happy.
Yeah. And when you see the rise, I mean, we don't know how many people were depressed in the 14th century. We have no idea. But certainly in the last 50 years, we seem to be seeing quite a marked increase in depression.
Yeah.
In the 14th century. Wow. You're kidding. That's amazing. Huh. Huh. Some people say if you go too high up this, you'll create misery. Voltaire, he made me laugh. He talked about the happy idiot. He says, I look at my brainless neighbor, and they seem to be quite happy in their brainlessness. Why would I choose to be happy? But he says, I must. I can't just stay in the state of what he called the happy idiot. That we need to pursue higher meanings. But I think a lot of the happiness surveys do reflect that there's a simplicity of life which makes for greater happiness.
Sorry. Who is it?
If you think that most people are operating and making decisions and choices based on affective reasons, do you think it would have to be affective reasons that would break them out beyond those fields to other fields? Or do you think it would be the other fields breaking in?
What a great question. I don't quite know where to go with that. It's an excellent question. Do we have to become so miserable on the affective side that pushes us to something more? I don't know, because Eva Eloise said this is the first time the affective field has really come into its own historically. She said this is a new social phenomena. And she says sociology now are analyzing this field in terms of the laws that govern it, what contains it. It's an observable field. In my own work, in terms of the evolution of consciousness, that just kind of ties in that we've reached a bit of a new state. So how we get out? I mean, I would say this is where the redemption part of the narrative comes in. We need an intervention beyond ourselves to break in and to pull us out. So I'm interested in reformation. So part of reformation would be looking at all these fields to see what we can do for ourselves and others to help the true happiness project. But I'm now going back to my old roots and saying we need a big revival. And when the Holy Spirit really falls on a people and a nation, there's a lot of happiness that goes with that, but it just pulls you out, so you get a much higher vision. I would say, you know, my thing, but the religious crossed out in terms of the transcendent field, almost blocked out altogether, and we're beginning to revolt. But if the universe did open up again, and we move beyond our materialism, that could break us out. What do you think? It's a great question.
I don't know. I guess, yeah, that redemption stepping in, and I suppose thinking that they're all connected, so there's hope that even if they might seem compartmentalized, they're not actually.
Yep, exactly. Perhaps. Yep, brilliant. Matthew, and then David.
Hi, my name is Matthew. Thank you so much for your talk. This was so interesting. So one question I had about your account of kind of the subjective or affective components is it seemed like the pathways you were mentioning and the types of affect all seemed to be types of positive affect. I'm curious to what extent you think that negative affect may be necessary for happiness in the sense of... So I'm just thinking about some kind of maybe comparison or counterfactual being necessary for true happiness. So Tolkien gives the example, he calls it the you catastrophe, right? Like there's this moment of supreme happiness that you experience when everything's kind of at its darkest, and then immediately, you know, kind of the eagles come or the ring gets thrown in the thing, and suddenly, you know, you think you're going to lose the battle, and then suddenly there's this great change, right? So this contrast... Or this kind of counterfactual between how things could have been. Aquinas in the Summa somewhat controversially thinks that those who are in the state of eternal blessedness are going to be in a continual state of perception of the kind of consciousness of the damned, so they can go, oh, wow, you know, great, like, we didn't end up like them. And so they're even happier than before, right? Yeah. Or even if we think about people like, you know, Beethoven or Kierkegaard, who had these, like, incredible, profound moments of happiness, but that seemed to have been weighted as even more positive level of affect because it was contrasted to these moments of supreme sorrow. So I guess I'm just curious, to what extent do you think negative affect plays a role in these states of positive affect as well, or maybe makes them possible or necessary?
So. I wanted to talk to you about this before I did this lecture, about that very thing, because I thought you might add something there. But it's interesting, Lewis's Sehnsucht, which is joy, and he actually distinguishes joy from happiness, which I do also. But Sehnsucht, the German word for deep longing, the inconsolable longing, and the way he describes it, it's not just positive. There's a deep negative side to it, too. It's inconsolable. He talks about it as a stab of joy. Stab. I mean, that doesn't sound altogether positive. There's both going on there. But in terms of the brain, do you have anything to offer on how it works there on that side? No, I'm gonna check that out. I really like the way you posit those two together. For me, the future, it becomes a problem in the future if we have to have the one to have the other. All the tear is going to be wiped away, we're told. But David,
we're going to have to cut it here for the time, but maybe if you could stick around a little bit longer, sure, and people can ask you questions then. Thanks for coming again tonight. If you'd like to hear this lecture again online, we'll be having it there shortly on christianheritage.org.uk, or you can just Google Round Church Cambridge. So let's thank Andrew again for tonight's talk.